You're listening to the PES on KZUU 90.7 FM, broadcasting live from the dark, damp dungeons of Smith Gym. You got Scotty and Tom on Monday afternoon. Reach us on the telephone at 335-2207, on the web at www.kzuu.org, and on the show's website, www.thepes.com.
The Whitman County Humane Society is in need of volunteers. Located in Pullman, the shelter is dedicated to caring for stray, abandoned, and abused animals. Opportunities include walking, feeding, and grooming the animals. For more information, call the shelter at 509-332-3422 or visit the website at www.whitmanpets.org. The dogs and cats will thank you. Had a bad weekend? Need legal counseling? Student Legal Services at WSU is happy to help. Student Legal Services is a student-run organization that provides free legal advice to students. So if you need help, stop by their office in Ad Annex Room 305. They are open Monday through Thursday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and Friday from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Like the water? Want to learn how to row? This summer, the WSU men's crew will once again sponsor the Palouse Community Rowing Program at Wawahi Landing on the Snake River. The program offers learn to row classes for adults of all ages and for youth ages 12 to 18. There is also an adult program called Master's Crew for those with rowing experience. Practices are in the evenings at 5:45 and on Saturday mornings, meeting three times a week. Adult learn to row and Master's Crew starts at May 24th. Junior learn to row classes start on June 14th. Visit www.row.wsu.edu for details. Interested in international studies or making new connections? The International Center is accepting applications for internships and peer mentors. Applications are due by March 31st in Smith Gym 214. Any questions, contact Chad Godin at 509-335-4223. WSU International Center, Composing One World.
I know Chad.
Do you?
Yes. KZUU DJs read public service announcements like what you heard every hour. If your club or nonprofit organization wants us to read a PSA about you, come to our office in Smith Gym, room 126B, or fill out a form online located in the staff button and email it to psa@kzuu.org. For more information, call our office, 335-2208. KZUU is made possible in part by Heroes in Sports, located at 245 Northeast Kamiokin Street. Pullman's Hometown Deli offers a variety of sandwiches, salads, and soups, with catering available. More information can be found by calling Heroes in Sports at 509-334-5423. And now, the favorite of the PES, the Reverend, Reverend Horton Heat. The favorite of the PES, the Reverend, Reverend Horton Heat. Tom, how was your weekend, sir?
It was good. How was yours?
It'd probably be better if I gave you a microphone. There we go. Now you can talk. How was your weekend?
It was good. How was yours, Scotty?
Any half marathons?
Not this weekend, no.
No? Didn't even get close to a half marathon?
I don't think so.
Third of a marathon?
No marathons were involved.
No marathons were involved. Okay.
How was your weekend, Scott?
It was busy. I think. I'm trying to remember. Yeah, I think. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I spent like 6 hours on Saturday in a draft. It was a fantasy baseball.
Yep.
And what we had a certain amount of money, like $260, and you had to auction pretty much on all the players you wanted. So, like, Alex Rodriguez came up, and if you bid, say, $100 on him, you had $160 to buy the rest of your team, which,
right,
you know, would really hurt you a lot. So you had to be careful with, you know, you had to sort of plan who you wanted and how much you're willing to pay to get the talent that you're looking for and what you're looking for, specific areas of stats. And we're doing a 6x6 matrix, I guess, or a, which essentially, most leagues do 5x5, but they added on OPS, which is on base plus slugging, and they added on the strikeout to walk ratio. So you had to look at a pitcher that, you know, you could get a pitcher that throws a lot of strikeouts, but then walks a ton of people, and that's going to hurt you. Versus a pitcher that does a lot of strikeouts and doesn't walk very many people. So, you know, you had to balance all these things out. And my team is pretty much the all-star team from 1996 or something like that. I got a lot of, like, old people.
The old guys.
Yeah, Troy Gloss is on my team. Ken Griffey Jr., Randy Johnson.
Ken Griffey Jr.
Ken Griffey Jr.
Were you a Mariners fan that one year where they almost, like, the closest they've ever gotten?
Well, see, you make know. That sound like I would be a bandwagon fan otherwise.
Well, no, I don't know how long you've been in the state of Washington. That's
my whole life.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I've been a Mariner fan the whole time.
The My Oh My season with like Joey Cora and
I went to the playoff game against the Yankees, game four, where we came back to win.
Is that the one with where Randy Johnson came in relief pitching?
No, that was game five.
That was game five.
That was game five. No, game four, we were down and Edgar Martinez came through in a big way and all sorts of cool stuff. But, I mean, Edgar Martinez came through all the time. And I'd have Edgar on my team if he was still available. But I got Jim Tomei. And I didn't get Frank Thomas, but...
He's definitely like 45 now, you know, at least.
Well, I mean, it's like... So my team... Oops. My team, I have... I don't think it's a horrible team. I have Albert Pujols... And then I picked up Felipe Lopez only to find out that he lost his starting position. So I'm going to have to and pretty much unless he gets on with another team, he's pretty much worthless now. I got Edgar Renteria, which isn't too bad. Grady Sizemore, JD Drew, which is another. You know, he was really good a couple years ago, and if he comes through again, Jermaine Dye, same kind of thing. Josh Beckett, who's hurt right now. Randy Johnson's hurt right now, but both of those would be good ones to have. I got JJ Putz, so I got a good closer, and. Got a couple other guys. Derek Jeter is one of my other players. And then...
just a side note.
Yes, yeah, a side note. I got that
Derek Jeter as Jeter, well. Yeah.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting. See, the thing was is that last season I was... outside of the Mariners, I don't know a lot about some of these baseball players, except when I play fantasy sports, you know, like I'll be, oh gosh, I need somebody who can hit home runs. So I'll go on and I'll look at the available players and I'll find somebody who has a lot of home runs. It was sort of a sleeper and pick them up and drop somebody from the team. And that's how I, you know, sometimes build up my team. And last season, this league that I'm in, it's a couple professors from WSU and some students and various other, you know, friends of friends type thing.
Yeah.
And, It was about a 6-hour draft, and last year I owned a team, but I didn't do anything with it. I was like George Steinbrenner. I hired a manager who did all the drafting for me and did the day-to-day stuff, but I fronted the money for the team. And so being true to my form, I fired my manager like 3 or 4 times throughout the season because I'd be mad.
Right.
I mean, jokingly mad. I could care less. But so anyway, this season he wasn't able to do the draft or anything like that, and... So I'm going to be ended up running this team, which is pretty much bad news because, like I said, outside of the Mariners and players from like 10 years ago, I don't really know a lot of the ones today. So yeah, it'll be sort of interesting to see what I can do with this.
Was the draft online or is that?
No, it was a live draft. We were over at one of the professor's house.
Oh wow!
And we started at 10 in the morning and got done a little after 4.
Huh.
So yeah, it was definitely a long day. And that was my Saturday, and then yesterday was Sunday, and it seems to me that I was busy. Oh, yes, softball. Oh, intramural softball has started, and for my teams, we play on Sundays. It snowed yesterday.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, sweet, the snow is slowing down, and one of the guys on the team starts laughing. He goes, that is not something you normally hear on the softball field, that the snow is slowing down. So... You know, I mean, the weather had been holding almost all day, and then once it comes time for softball, then, of course, it decides to start snowing. And, you know, by the time the game really got going, there's actually a little blanket of white on the ground, and I pitched the first men's game. And I'd go out there between innings, and I'd seriously have to search for the ball because it would blend in with the ground. I couldn't find it. And then the first 2 or 3 batters, I actually was just pitching approximately where I thought the pitcher's mound would be. And then after about 2 batters, the umpire came over, who was the base umpire, and he goes, there's actually a pitcher's mound there. I'm like, where? Because I was playing on field 2, which is one of the lower fields, so it was a swamp. The pitcher's mound was pure mud. The home plate area was pure mud. The outfield had about 2 inches of water on it. And so
that sounds like fun.
Yeah, I started stomping around, and finally I found the hard spot in the mud, and I'm like, oh, there it is. And I sort of wiped it away, so I had that for the rest of the game. And then the second game, we went up to field 4, which is a higher up field, so the ground, except around by second base where it was really bad, other than that, it was actually a decent field to play on. And the teams who had been playing up there that had to go down to our field, they're all whining and complaining about it. Oh, I don't want to play. I don't want to play. I'm like, shut up, you whiner, and get out there and play. Let us have the nice field this time. I mean, because we actually had a co-ed game out on that same field, so we were already sort of used to playing out on that nastiness.
Right.
But, anyway, we went on to win. the men's game. I think one of them, I don't know, is 14 to 6 or something like that. And that game was ended due to time. And then the second game we played, we were up 12-0. Well, we were up like 9-0. And we get one guy on base, and one of our big hitters goes up there and hits it over their head and gets inside the park home run. And then they all start walking off the field, and we're like, game ain't over yet. They're like, well, I thought it was over after one run scored. It's like, no, you guys are still mathematically in it. So the pitcher looks at the rest of you guys, you guys want to continue playing? They're like, no. So they walked off the field.
I wouldn't either in snow.
Oh, whiner. It stopped snowing by then. It was actually not bad. I had even taken off. I'd already shed two coats. I was actually wearing a T-shirt and some Under Armour, and that was about it. So it wasn't that bad. Though, I'll tell you what, my hitting was horrible. And I don't know. I'm hoping it was just an anomaly.
You should blame it on the low visibility.
Well, I would, except for the fact that everybody else hit just fine. So I don't have anything to blame it on other than myself. You know, I mean, it's like, well, I haven't hit in 5 or 6 months. Well, neither has anybody else. Well, yeah. I haven't swung a bat in 5. Neither has anybody else. So I had no excuse for me hitting that much worse than everybody else on the team. And luckily, they carried us. And to be honest with you, the teams we played against were not the greatest teams in the world. They would be rec division teams at best. So anyway, we'll have some real competition one of these days. But Speaking of competition, I want you, Tom, to try the world's easiest quiz. And if you'd like to play along at home, or if you want to call in 335-2207 and go against Tom and see who is the smartest person at the world's easiest quiz, You can do so. I doubt anybody would be able to beat you, though, Tom, because you are the man.
I'm kind of guessing this is going to be like a quiz of trick questions.
No trick questions.
Yeah, okay.
No.
Let's,
Number one.
I'm ready.
How long did the Hundred Years' War last? Don't worry about saying it. Just write down your answer. How long did the Hundred Years' War last?
How many questions is this quiz?
10. Just 10. And so the first question, how long did the Hundred Years' War last? And number two, in which country are Panama hats made? Which country are Panama hats made? Tom's looking at me like, is there such a country as Panama? Now he's giving me the evil eye.
Pretty sure Panama hats are made somewhere else.
What? This is the world's easiest quiz. Don't make it harder on you than it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, number three, where do we get catgut? The question is, where do we get catgut? Tom's writing quickly here. We could be on Jeopardy. Oh, too bad on my handy-dandy CD I don't have of my sound effects and Cartmanisms. You would think I'd have a Jeopardy song on here somewhere, huh? That'd be perfect for right now. I got Strange Brew and Yosemite Sam, Marvin Martian, yes, Cartman, of course, James Bond theme.
What a shame.
Okay,
let's continue with the Eat World's Easiest Quiz.
Okay. Do you like The X-Files, MASH, Pink Panther, Superman, Tales from the Crypt, The Good, Bad, The Ugly, Magnificent Seven, Rockford Files, A-Team, Top Gun, Cops, Desperado, Entertainment Tonight, Highlander, James Bond? Any of those scream out at you? We gotta have some background music.
Is this part of the quiz?
No. This is what do you want as your background music to give you?
James Bond would be great.
Bond. Okay. Let's go to some James Bond here, and that will give you some. What's the word I'm looking for? It will give you some encouragement. It will give you some.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it will make you want to do better because you're like, what would James Bond do?
Right.
WWJBD. What would James Bond do? So we'll give you a little bit of. There we go. All right. Is that setting the mood for you?
Oh, I guess. Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Now that you have some James Bond music. Okay, so question number one. How long did the Hundred Years' War last? Okay. Question number two. I know.
Okay.
I'm just recapping.
All right. Great.
Because we took a little break. And for the people at home who are playing along, in which country are Panama hats made? Number three, where do we get catgut? And number four, what are moleskin trousers made of? What are moleskin trousers made of?
Hmm.
Once again, this is the world's easiest quiz, and Tom is taking it, and he seems to be not doing very well. I don't know. I haven't seen his answers yet, but the looks on his face just make me worry. Number five. Louis XVIII was the last one. But how many previous kings of France were also called Louis or Louis? Are you done?
Yep.
Okay, that was quick. And number six. What kind of creatures were the Canary Islands named after? Once again, Tom, my partner, doing the world's easiest quiz. Number seven. What was King George VI's first name? King George VI. What was his first name?
I don't know that one.
King George. What was his first name?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure this is an entire quiz of trick questions, like I said at the beginning.
No. It's the world's easiest quiz.
Yeah, okay.
So here we are.
Scotty.
Giving Tom...
Scotty George the 8th.
All right. Okay, number 8. Okay. What color is the purple finch? What color is the purple finch? Okay. Number 9. What is a camel hair's brush made of? Number 9. What is a camel hair's brush made of? And number 10. How long did the 30 Years' War last? How long did the 30 Years' War last?
30 Years' War. That was like Germany, right? During the Reformation. I want to say...
Tom's giving away some hints. Call in 335-2207 if you want to go against Tom. 335-2207. Tom seems to be writing a lot for having a number.
I'm still on the camel hair brush one. I'm not sure about that one.
Okay. Did you do number 10 yet?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. So, are there any ones you want to recap?
Not really.
Okay. Alrighty, we got about a minute and 30 seconds left for you to write down your answer.
Okay, I'm done.
Okay,
as ready as I'm ever going to be.
Alright, so here, let's question number one. How long did the 100 years war last? What was your answer, Tom?
I put 74 years.
The answer is 116 years, from 1337 to 1453. So number one is wrong. Okay, number two. In what country are the Panama hats made? Tom said
the UK.
They're made in Ecuador.
In Ecuador?
Ecuador.
Okay.
All right. Number three. Where do we get catgut?
Put sheep intestines.
That is correct. Sheep and horses. Ding, 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 ding.
Dang, I got one.
Hey, way to go, Tom. Number four. What are moleskin trousers made of?
Put suede.
Hard-wearing cotton fabric with a soft cap. So there you go. Hard. Okay.
Yeah.
Number five. Louis XVIII was the last one, but how many previous kings of France were also called Louis?
I put 5.
16. The one known as Louis XVII died in prison during the French Revolution, thus never reaching the throne. What kind of creatures were the Canary Islands named after?
Fish.
A large breed of dogs. There you go.
How does that make sense?
Because of the Latin name of the breed of dogs, stands for Island of the Dogs. It's like Insularia Canaria. There you go, the Canary Islands.
Fair enough.
All right. What was King George VI's first name?
I put Scotty.
Scotty. Close.
Scotty George.
Close. Very close. So it was Albert.
Huh. That is close.
Well, it's... at least you didn't say George. When he came to the throne in 1936, he respected the wish of Queen Victoria that no future king should be called Albert. There you go. And number eight, what color is the purple finch?
Brown.
Crimson. Crimson, my brother. We're crimson and gray. It was a crimson. The distinct part, colored parts are crimson. There you go. Number nine.
But it's mostly brown. It just says the distinctively colored parts.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. So what? I got that one right.
What is the camel hair's brush made of?
I want to put... I didn't actually end up putting an answer for this. I'm going to say dog hair.
Squirrel fur. It got its name from a German inventor named Kemmel. K-E-M-E-L. There you go.
So, like, somewhere there's this big farm of squirrels?
I guess.
And they just skin them?
I don't know. That'd be sort of weird. And how long did the 30 years war last?
I put 62 years.
30 years? Duh. How could you... I know. Mm-hmm. Poor Tom. All right. So, Tom, how did you do?
I got one, and then the other one where the finches were mostly brown.
Whatever.
Yeah.
No. Okay, so Tom got one correct. I did get them all correct, because I was actually reading off my answer key when I was reading it to you.
Yeah, whatever.
What? You don't believe me?
You're such a liar.
What?
Yeah.
Why do you hate on me so much, Tom?
Because you make me do quizzes I don't want to do.
Oh, you did too. Okay, how about an easier one? Do you want to do an easier one?
Not really.
We'll just do a couple ones.
No, that's okay.
You'll know this. For instance, which bounces higher, a ball of steel or a ball of rubber?
A ball of rubber?
Ball of steel. How would you not know that?
No, it doesn't.
Yes, it does.
Prove it. Not only
give me a ball of steel and a ball of rubber.
Not
and a ball
only
of
would it depend on the surface you bounce it on, but where you bounced it, for instance. I mean, like, what if you bounced it on the moon? I'm going to need some more specific data.
Okay, how about this?
Data.
Google means an enormous number. Can you define it more precisely?
No.
You really? You know, it's interesting because at one
is
time...
A billion billions?
Well, at one time, there was a lot of people that didn't know what a Google was or a Googleplex.
Right.
What it is it's a zero or it's a one followed by 100 zeros.
Okay.
So that's a Google. And I believe that's Googleplex or Google is where Google.com got their name.
I'm sure, yeah.
So sort of interesting there. Now, okay. Well, let's do one more here. Let's find a good one. For the Louisiana Purchase lands, the U.S. paid France less than 3 cents per acre. What did it pay Russia per acre for Alaska?
Less than 1 cent?
2 cents. Two cents an acre, yeah. Yeah, I figured you might know that one from all your information that you've received throughout your schooling and whatnot. But speaking of schooling...
You thought I might know the cents per acre that we paid Russia for Alaska.
Well, you didn't learn that in school? I'm sorry. You actually learned things like self-esteem and how to protest or...
you must have gone to private school, Scotty.
You feel good about yourself. You might not know the answer, but by golly, you feel good about the fact you don't know the right answer. Because did you learn daily affirmations?
I think this is
I'm good enough.
Unfounded
I'm smart enough. And doggone it, people like me.
This is an unfounded attack.
Is that what you did every morning instead of the Pledge of Allegiance in school? I'm just curious. I'm not saying you, Tom, but I'm saying you in general in your period of going to school.
Of course not. What kind of question is that?
Did you do the Pledge of Allegiance daily?
Yeah.
Did you?
Yep.
Wow. Very good. Very good.
It's a requirement for public schools. Everybody does it.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Sure. Wink. My school.
It is a requirement for...
I'm not kidding.
It's a requirement
for
public school.
You have to
do it.
You're right. It's a requirement, and everybody does it. Wink. I was definitely in a school where we didn't do it every day.
Were you in a private school?
No.
Really?
I went to public school. Yes, sir. Why, do you think I have a public or a private education?
I never heard of anybody that went to public school that didn't do the Pledge of Allegiance every day.
Well, I did. When I was in elementary school, yes. Middle school, yes. High school, no. I don't know.
Actually, hold on. Maybe definitely in elementary school, but I'm trying to think.
Every day in elementary school, because I remember different years. Like one year it'd be there on the on the wall, and then one year my teacher, if you got picked for the week, you were the one who got to hold the American flag up on this pole. And then the teacher would lead us in Pledge of Allegiance.
Actually, I'm trying to think. Maybe it's only a requirement for elementary school.
I don't know.
Because I can't remember now. Maybe we didn't do it in high school.
Because I know in high school we very rarely did it.
Yeah.
Middle school.
Like maybe for like assemblies or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I don't.
Middle school, we did it. Middle school, we did it. Like they, you know, you'd have two students that would read the daily bulletin over the intercom system, and they would always lead the Pledge of Allegiance for the whole school, and then they'd read the daily bulletin. And that's how we did it in middle school. And like I said, elementary school, it was led usually by the teacher. But once we got to high school,
do you think that's because like you're not required to attend high school?
I don't know. That's a good question. What's interesting is there was an article that appeared in the Daily News, and I don't know if it's in today's Evergreen or not. Speaking of today's Evergreen, I meant to grab one because there was an article about the latest interview for WSU Police Chief. They've now gone through like three or four candidates, and it's not that they've washed out the candidates. It's the candidates come here and go, oh, no, thank you, and leave. But the one that's currently being looked at is a guy named Bill Gardner. Now, Bill Gardner is a Pullman local, became a WSU police officer, and then he became a Pullman police officer and was between the two agencies. I think he served about 15 years. He was a DARE officer before he left Pullman, and he went off into the private sector working for a company, I want to say in Utah or something like that, for a couple years as a consultant. And he applied, and he was up at Leidy last Friday with the community forum portion of it and stuff, and there's an article on the front page of the Evergreen about the about that. And I wanted to read, maybe I'll do that during a break and see what he had to say at the forum, if there's anything of note or whatever. But it'd be interesting if he got it, because, you know, at least he knows about Pullman. Like, some of these other people were coming from, like, Philadelphia. It's like, Pullman? Wait a minute. That's nowhere close to Seattle. No, thank you.
Yeah.
Because I talked to a guy who was working for WSU, the alum, or some sort of fundraising portion of some part of WSU. And he took the job more or less sight unseen because he thought WSU was located in Seattle. So he was quite pleasantly not surprised when he arrived in Pullman, Washington. Quite a bit away from Seattle. So
just a little bit.
So anyway, the article in the Daily News was about a professor in architecture, I think it was 202, which is they deal with the aesthetics of building and land and landscape and all that kind of stuff. Well, anyway, the professor led the students. Well, the professor, I guess I don't know specifically how it all worked, but essentially.
Was this in the Evergreen?
It was in the Daily News, the Pullman Moscow Daily News. And there might be an article about it in the Evergreen as well, but they had photos of it in the Daily News. But essentially, the professor and his students went up to the. What's that place called? Bishop Boulevard. And they were protesting the design of the buildings and the layout of how they're doing everything. They're pretty much protesting the whole thing, saying that it's piecemeal, it's ugly, there's no aesthetic value of anything that they got going on in there. And
is that
professor,
in Moscow or Bishop Boulevard, where is that? I don't know where that is.
Do you know where Safeway is?
Yeah.
That's okay. Bishop Boulevard.
Oh, okay. All right.
So they're up there protesting all this stuff, and what was interesting is the professor gave extra credit for anybody who went up and protested. But he said in order to be fair for people who didn't, you know, feel that way or whatever, he would allow them to write a paper to explain why they didn't want to go up and protest, and he would give them extra credit. There was no indication on whether, you know, their paper, you know, length or anything like that on the paper, but one would still question whether a professor leading a protest and giving extra credit to students who participated, if that's really the right position for a professor to be taking. Now, what's interesting is you could say, well, as a professor, if my goal is to teach my architecture students how to protest, I could teach them in general how to protest, how to go through everything, but to allow them the issue to choose and everything else from there on out. But if the professor is the one who says, okay, guys, we're going to go up and protest this for these reasons, and if you come along, I'm going to give you extra credit. there's a big difference there. And it's interesting. I don't know what your thoughts are on professors who would use a classroom environment to more or less further a political cause.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, the question, I guess what he's really asking him to do, is, since he provided the opportunity for students that didn't want to protest or whatever, what he's really asking them to do is just take a position on the subject. I mean,
I don't think he was asking them to take a position, because if that's the case, you'd have both sides write a paper one way or the other and allow those who wanted to protest as well to go out and protest. The point was is that they wanted to go out and protest, but in order not to, more or less, to not hose the people who didn't feel that way over, he had to allow them an opportunity via, say, the paper to say, no, I don't agree with this, and this is why, and then they would get the extra credit as well. I don't think he was, because you don't need to go out there and have one group protest and one group write a paper in order to see what side of group's on.
Yeah.
You could have them raise their hand if that was the case. They were taking a political stance on the development in the construction that's going on in Pullman. And the question, I mean,
seems a little weird, I guess.
It's not necessarily a bad thing that the students want to take a stand one way or the other on an issue like that. Where I believe the issue comes in is when the students are offered extra credit because the teacher's leading them on some sort of protest, or at least that's what the article makes it appear.
It seems a little weird, I guess.
So the article, they had signs. One of them was protesting the architecture of the area.
Yeah.
I mean, the sign said, "Stop architecture in Pullman. The show starts on the sidewalk."
That sounds like the work of a sarcastic student. I like that. Yeah.
And then haphazard development and sprawl. You know, and that's interesting that they call it sprawl on the boulevard when you got a town that's like 2 miles from one side to the other that includes 17,000 people of, you know, apartments and houses and businesses, and that's considered sprawl. It's all within the well-defined city limits of Pullman and has been within the city limits of Pullman forever.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what somebody's definition of sprawl is, but to me, that's not sprawl.
The definition of sprawl is Tri-Cities, Washington. Yeah, you should go there if you want to see sprawl. It's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, why would you call it sprawl?
Just because the amount of land that's being used for it's an area of about 200,000 people, but I don't know. Have you been to the Tri-Cities before, Sky?
Yes.
Then you know.
Been through.
Right? You've never stopped. Did you go through at Christmas? Because the lights on the used car dealerships are stunning, let me tell you.
No, I can't say that I've gone through during Christmas time. Yeah. But, you know, it's just, I guess the thing is, it's like one person was trying to argue, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with what this professor did because he was just trying to get the students involved and, you know, teaching them how to do this kind of stuff. And, you know, my point of view would be, it's one thing to teach them how to protest, it's another to tell them what to protest. And I think that's where you come in. And, you know, when this first was happening, and, you know, I'm hearing a lot of it, there's a lot of people saying that, you know, you need to call Elson Floyd, you need to call the auditor, the Washington State University auditor, and other things like that to take a look into this whole situation. And I was, at first, I was like, you know, the one thing I don't like is when, you know, somebody doesn't like something, they complain, and then the whole entire group can no longer do it anymore because of the complaints of a few. And I was like, man, this could be a same kind of situation like that, you know, where I've been in different jobs before where, you know, for a long time, you've always done a certain thing, like you might go to lunch and while you go to lunch, you're wearing, say, some sort of item from the place you work, where it's never a big deal.
Exactly what you're talking about.
But then all of a sudden, one time somebody complains about it, and then it's like, well, you can't do that anymore. And it's like, so we're causing a huge change of practice because one person didn't like what they saw, and you have thousands that have theoretically seen it over the years and they've never said anything, but one or two speak up and then all of a sudden, you know, everybody sort of gets punished for it. And I was thinking the same kind of thing could be the case here where, you have a situation where, you know, they're doing something and now a couple people are being really noisy about it and they can't do it anymore. But then I was like, well, I think there's definitely a big fundamental difference here when I started looking at this. In this situation, the professor was doing a political act.
Yeah.
By having these people go out and protest this. And when you open up to a political act and start doing something politically, you got to be ready for the ramifications of your actions.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in other situations where you're not doing anything political, you're just being somewhere and somebody complains. So, I mean, to me, I see a big difference between what this person did and the backlash and, say, what other people do sometimes and the backlash from that. You know, it'd be one thing if you were out in your work shirt holding up picket signs, right?
Yeah.
And if they complained about the fact, not that you were picketing, but the fact you were picketing in your work shirt.
Right.
Versus, you know, I mean, if these students had just gone up there and it had nothing to do with that class, or if there had been no incentive of extra credit to go up there and do that, I don't think there would be any kind of real backlash.
Maybe he should have, like,
because
it seemed like it might be a good learning experience if you're in architecture, you need to, this is the kind of political overtones that some of your, you know, some building projects might have. But maybe the professor should have just advertised the protest, said during class, said, you know, put up an overhead, says, you know, there's a protest going on at this place at this time. And it would be might be a good learning experience for you to come. But, yeah, I agree. Adding with the incentive to attend, it seems a little sketchy a little bit.
So have you been in a class where they've offered extra credit to do some sort of political activity?
I think so. I think the one that comes to mind right now is high school government. It wasn't actually extra credit. We were required to go participate in a political activity.
But what class was that?
Government.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was it your PE class? I mean,
it was my government class.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's the other point, too, also, that's sort of interesting, is it's an architecture class.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a poli-sci, or it's not a...
Well, politics is everything, Scotty.
I don't necessarily believe that.
People plus anything equals politics.
No, yes. No. When I play dodgeball, it has nothing to do with politics. When I play softball, it has nothing to do with politics. Softball,
but sports,
zero politics.
People plus sports equals politics. All you got to do is watch the hearings on Capitol Hill that are going on Capitol Hill for the last month about the use of, you know, steroids.
I think that's a bunch of crud right there, man. How do you think S without it, man. I'm nothing.
Yeah, I'm just saying that politics can be found everywhere.
But I don't think it...
Including in architecture. But I think we were in agreement that university incentive, it's almost like an endorsement of the activity. So
sure. So it's sort of interesting. I'm curious what kind of outcome, or if there's going to be any kind of real heat coming to this professor over this, or if it's going to sort of drop by the wayside, if it's going to be yet another one of those situations where one group of people in Pullman didn't like it because of the message that was being put out, and the other group of people in Pullman liked it because of the message that was being put out. Therefore, you know, one group will argue for it, or, you know,
because
the thing is that if you look at the development on Bishop Boulevard, one of the things that the person was saying in here is that the buildings are set so far back off the roadway, and they have these huge parking lots out front, and that's just it. You know, it's horrible for the landscaping and all that kind of things. And you know, I mean, Tom Forbes, one of the old co-hosts of the show who has the blog Palousatix.com, has photos of a lot of the buildings on Bishop Boulevard, as well as a lot of the buildings on Grand Avenue. And he posted them. And really, I mean, the buildings, I don't think, are bad-looking buildings. They're not, especially when you compare them to some of the ones that are in the downtown area. They're nice-looking buildings. They, you know, they have, you know, it's not just a bland-looking box or whatever. I think part of the problem is that people, especially those who are, like, everything should be, you know, the old 1950 model of downtown. You live close to downtown, or you live in the downtown area. You walk and buy your groceries or whatever in the downtown area. You might work in that area. You're close enough to walk to most activities you need to do. The idea of needing a car is, you know, pretty obscure. that kind of mentality, I think it's all neat and fun when you think about what it was like back in the day, but I don't think we're back in the day anymore. I think that we've gone past that. People want different things. It's sort of like TV used to be three channels, and it was very easy to choose what to watch because you only had three choices. Right. Now you have hundreds of channels. And to complain that there's too much to choose from and people, you know, it's too confusing to figure out what to choose from and there's so much garbage out there in order to fill all the hours on TV, it's one of those things where the reason why it's like that is because people are demanding it. People want one-stop shopping. People want to be able to park close to where they're shopping, to be able to go in, get their stuff done, and go home. They don't want to spend a couple hours going from store to store to store to store, parking three or four blocks from where they are shopping.
Yeah.
And have to spend all this time doing that kind of stuff. People are comfortable with name brand recognition. And people prefer, in a lot of cases, to shop where they're comfortable shopping. For some people, it's shopping at the place that they've been shopping since they're a kid. And it could be the hardware store that exists in no other town. It's just the one hardware store in that one town. And that's where people like to shop. They're comfortable shopping there. They trust the people they work that are there. And they go there. Some people like the big name brands because they know, hey, if I go to, say, Coast to Coast or Ace Hardware, I know what I'm getting every single time I go there, and no matter which store I go to, I know what I'm getting. And some people like that as a comfort. And for others to say, well, you know, it's hurting the downtown, it hurt the mom and pop stores, it's like, well, I'm sorry for them, but this is where I prefer to shop. And who are you to tell me that I shouldn't shop where I prefer?
On a closely related subject, Scotty.
Yes, sir.
Have you been seeing what's going on in North Korea right now?
I don't know.
You haven't been following that. Where last week?
I guess not.
Yeah, I was joking. I was being sarcastic about this being a closely related subject.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, haven't been.
No.
Well, there's an election in South Korea.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And conservative government was voted in, and they indicated right when they got into office that they're going to curtail the sunshine policy. Do you know about that?
The sunshine policy? I'm not quite sure what the sunshine policy is.
Right. It's South Korea's plan. It's its policy towards North Korea. And what it is basically, I mean, they want... Most South Koreans regard... Well, many South Koreans regard North Korea as kind of a wayward younger brother, you know, okay. Or something like that, that shouldn't be punished harshly all the time. Needs to be, you know, kind of just brought gently back into the fold. They have like a ministry for unification where they're working towards unification with North Korea, supposedly, you know, and of course the North Koreans are having none of this, but they like the sunshine policy because it provides them with billions and billions of dollars of mostly food aid and other kinds of, like, humanitarian aid. But the conservative government indicated that they're going to curtail this policy pretty drastically, contingent on North Korea's compliance with its nuclear... dismantling its nuclear program. So you haven't been seeing any of the things that... The thing that really brought... I was just... Right before the show, I was reading the New York Times, and the North Korean, I think it was the Foreign Ministry, announced that if there's any kind of provocation by South Korea, they will not hesitate to turn it into ashes. Was a direct quote.
And you thought about me and my way of dealing with
problems. Yeah, the general theme of you using nuclear war to solve almost any problem. But yeah, that was kind of... I was reading about, you know, past statements they've made, and apparently this is not too extraordinary. They just haven't done it for a couple decades.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, they've. I think it was in 1996, they threatened to turn South Korea into a sea of fire.
Oh,
which
sweet.
Didn't happen either, but, I mean, this time they have nuclear weapons, so everyone's getting a little bit more press, I guess.
Interesting. But no, I can't say
They've been test-firing missiles and... making statements like, if South Korea goes into our shared coastal zone again with their navy, we'll open fire, and this kind of thing. They have naval skirmishes pretty often.
Yeah.
About it once every couple of years. But
huh.
So, kind of interesting. I don't know. I've been following that story. It'll be interesting to see what happens, because it looks like for a little bit that North Korea was actually, you know, one of our success, not a success story, but we've finally had got them to the negotiating table and got them to agree to dismantle their nuclear program, and now it's taking too long, and there's a little bit of more and more controversy, and it seems like, you know,
wow.
It seems like it's kind of slipping.
You can't trust the North Koreans.
It looks like it's kind of slipping away. Yeah.
Interesting. I think that's the difference between the whole, well, let's negotiate and make things happy and peace, versus, let's just take care of things, all right?
Okay.
Let's take off the belt, put them over the knee, deal with them.
Yeah, we tried that.
Or we could go, honey, now go stand in the corner for 10 minutes and think about why you're standing there. I'm going to count to three, and if you don't do what I tell you, I'm going to count to three a second time, and if you don't do what I tell you, I'm going to count to three a third time, and if you don't do what I tell you, I'm going to count to four a third time, you know, or count to three a fourth time. It's like...
Yeah, well, there's a basic kind of, I don't know, I guess a basic tenet in military thinking is that you don't invade countries with nuclear weapons. I mean, call me crazy, but that's just one of the things that you just don't do. So, I don't know. I'm not sure what you're going for here, but...
I guess all I was saying is that with people who believe that you can negotiate anything, I think that they're fools, because all they're doing is they're negotiating the other side more time to do what they want to do. Mm-hmm. You know, wasn't the Israelis who would they'd see one of the countries over there getting close to nuclear stuff, and they'd just fire up a couple jets and blow up their factories, and then go back and wait.
Yeah,
they did
it a couple times. It was Iraq in 1982 and Syria pretty recently, about 4 months ago, I think.
You know, and it's just like that took care of problems. You know, if Israel tried to go to the tables with them and keep on negotiate, in the time of the negotiations, guess what? People are getting the things that they're trying to, the negotiations are trying to stop to happen. Words on a piece of paper are not worth anything more than the person who is agreeing to those words on a piece of paper. I think the Indians found that out many, many, many years ago, and I think people still find that out today. Restraining orders are words on a piece of paper.
Are you talking about Native Americans or...
Indians, yeah.
The Indians.
Yes.
Native Americans, not the people from India.
Correct.
Oh, I was just curious India is a non-nuclear proliferation treaty country.
Uh-huh.
They have nuclear weapons as well. That's why I thought you were maybe talking about them. But you're talking about Indian treaties.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, I understand.
Okay. So, yeah, there's this thing I wanted to do with you. Well, that sounded so bad. I am apologizing for that. There was a thing I wanted to read to you.
Okay.
Does that sound a little better?
Thank you.
Tom, he's like, look at that time. I got to go now.
I'm really busy.
Okay. This is, I think it would be a lot of fun, especially if, you know, and I... You know, as we were talking next week, hopefully we'll get some people on about the concealed carry on campus. It would be great to get somebody from both sides so we could, you know, get a point-counterpoint thing going. Even if we can't get them the same time, we might be able to do one than the other. But I think the point-counterpoint would be a lot more fun when you're here next week. But this thing, it's sort of fun in a political context to talk about this and try to figure out, you know, it figures out where somebody's coming from, what their point of view is, you know, because it would seem to me when I read this, it's very clear what the correct answer is.
Okay.
But other people read it and they come up with different things, and it's sort of interesting. So I'll try to read it to you without stumbling through it too badly. And it goes like this. And if you want to put in your 2 cents on it, you're able to as well, 335-2207. And I'll read that. I'll give that phone number again after I'm done reading this. But it'd be interesting if anybody else wants to put in their 2 cents, what they think about this. But here goes. Recently, some friends asked me to dinner to meet a visiting doctor from Ohio, a plump, comfortable man of about 60 who was in New York for a meeting of a psychiatric association. Afterward, over coffee, he said he would like to tell us a rather curious love story to find out what we thought of it. A long time ago, he said, there was only one bridge across the Ohio River between Cincinnati and Covington, Kentucky. Not far from the Cincinnati end of the bridge lived a lovely woman who was married to an elder manufacturer of machine tools. Discovering after a few years that her husband was more interested in lathes than her, she began looking around for solace. Eventually, she found it, in a person of a handsome young sportsman who bred and trained racehorses near Covington. She paid him frequent afternoon visits, always taking care to get home before her husband returned from the office. One spring afternoon, as she started to drive back to Cincinnati, she found that a flood was sweeping down the Ohio River, foamy brown water swirling around the floor planking of the bridge. The pilings were shaking as if they might give away at any moment. The only other way across the river was by ferry about a mile downstream. She hurried there and found, to her immense relief, that the boat was still running. When she looked in her purse for the fare, she saw, however, she had no money. Surely, though, the ferryman would trust her till tomorrow. He wouldn't. He explained that he'd be glad to let her ride for free if it was his decision on his own, but the ferry owner had given him strict instructions not to credit anybody. If he broke this rule, he would be fired. Sorry. The woman drove rapidly back to her lover's house, asked him for a dollar. To her astonishment, he too refused. "Don't you see," he said, "that if the question of money ever should come into our relationship, even a single dollar, everything would be changed. I love you far too much for that. You think me ridiculous, idealistic, but if you insist on demanding money from me, I can never see you again." Once more she drove towards the river, this time trembling with rage, a rage of fury at her lover and the fear of the wrath of her husband. She determined to force her way across the bridge in spite of hell and high water. She didn't make it, of course. Her body was never found. The doctor paused to take a sip of coffee, then asked, who do you think was responsible for the girl's death? So if you want to chime in on this, you can, 335-2207. And in the meantime, I'm going to see what Tom thinks.
I actually want to see what you think, Scotty.
Oh, you'll hear what I think, but I'm sort of curious where you're going with it.
I only have about 3 more minutes left.
I know, so that's why we need to hear you.
Hear you say your thoughts on that. Well, I mean, I'd really hold both the adulterers responsible.
Both of them responsible? Why both?
Because they're committing adultery.
Okay, fair enough. So
that's my
so
answer.
Her death was the people responsible was both the lover and her for her death.
Yeah.
Okay, so can you explain why he is responsible a little bit more?
Because he was committing adultery.
Okay, so if it wasn't for the adultery, she wouldn't be dead, and that's why she died.
Yeah.
It's 'cause the adultery.
What do you think?
She's responsible for her own death. Plain and simple. I don't think anybody else is responsible for her death. And see, the thing is that some people say, well, the ferry boat guy is responsible for her death, because if he hadn't been unwilling to bend the rules, or if he pawned off this decision on his non-present owner, who may or may not have ever found out that he had done this. So he very well could have turned a blind eye, allowed her on, got the dollar the next day, and the owner would have never been any wiser. So it's his fault that she died. Some people say, well, it's her husband's fault, because he doesn't care about her. All he cares about is his work, and doesn't care about making sure that she feels all of her emotional needs and desires are being taken care of. So therefore, if he had been a better husband, she wouldn't have had to find solace somewhere else, and therefore she wouldn't be on the other side of the river, and she wouldn't have had to feel like she had to get home before he made it home, which was the cause of her death, because she felt she had to make it home. So it's his fault. Then other people said, well, it's the lover's fault, because it was only a dollar. He should not have taken such an idealistic stance on this whole thing. He should have just given her the dollar so she got home safely. And I say it's her fault, because she's the one who made the decision to drive across the bridge. She's the one who made the decision to get in an affair. She's the one who made the decision to do a lot of the things that she's doing that got her into the position that she was in. She very well could have just called the husband and said, hey, honey, I came over to this area. And if she wanted to continue with a lie, because she's already doing adultery, so what's a lie, right? All she had to say is, hey, honey, I'm over on this side of the river. There's some flood going on. I can't make it back. I'm going to get across as soon as I can. There's a lot of things that could have happened a little differently. But in my view, and this goes back to look at the person in the mirror. The person in the mirror is the one to blame. She made the decision, which cost her her life. And that's why I say she's the one responsible for her death. And I think that's, and I think what's interesting, and this is why, especially when I get some of my left-wing friends around, I always like to hear their responses to this, because to
are
me...
Are you referring to me as left-wing, Scott?
No, not at all.
Oh, okay.
I'm just, I mean, in your case, you're just here, but I just, I think it's, it would be interesting to see where other people are coming from, because, mm-hmm. I, you know, like I said, I am all about taking responsibility for your own actions.
Yeah.
She was making actions. She needs to take responsibility. Well, I mean, she's responsible for those actions. So anyway, I understand it's 1300.
It would be interesting to compare your different friends' responses to that. Yeah. Yeah. That it is.
Because to me, it seems black and white, clear as crystal. She's responsible for her own actions, right? Other people don't quite see it that way. Other people can find reasons to blame other people. And to me, those are the ones who also blame. For instance, I'm walking down the sidewalk and I slip and fall and I blame the city for it.
Right.
I'm the one who was walking. I was the one who slipped and fell. Well, there shouldn't have been gravel on the sidewalk. Well, I should have been more careful when I was walking. I mean, it's just, anyway. Once again, Tom, you got to run off, I know. We will be back together next week. Same bat time, same bat channel.
Absolutely. All right, thanks, Scotty.
Yep. Have yeah. a good day. See you later, Tom. And in the meantime, the favorite of the PES, the Reverend. Reverend Horton Heat. Listening to the PES on KZUU 90.7 FM, broadcasting live from the dark, damp dungeons of Smith Gym. You've got Scotty in the afternoon. The Whitman County Humane Society is in need of volunteers. Located in Pullman, the shelter is dedicated to caring for the stray, abandoned, and abused animals. Opportunities include feeding, walking, and grooming the animals. For more information, call the shelter at 332-3422 or visit them on their website, www.whitmanpets.org. The dogs and cats will thank you with their unconditional love. Had a bad weekend? Need legal counseling? Student Legal Services at WSU is happy to help. Student Legal Services is a student-run organization that provides free legal advice to students. So if you need their help, stop by their office in at Annex Room 305. They're open Monday through Thursday, 9 to 5, and Friday, 9 to 1. Speaking Japanese, if you please. Learn Japanese for free. Everyone is welcome to join in on the good times at the Neo Public Library every Tuesday. Beginners can learn about Japanese culture and basic speaking and writing skills from 4:30 to 5:15 p.m. Intermediate students will focus on grammar and vocabulary from 5:15 to 6 p.m. And advanced class with one-on-one teaching meets at 5:30 to 6:15 p.m. Contact Kimi Hirose at 432-3903 or the Neo Public Library at 334-3595 for more information. KZUU DJ's Republic Service announcements like what you just heard every hour. If your club or nonprofit organization wants us to read a PSA about you, come to our office in Smith Gym Room 126B or fill out the form online located under the staff button and email it to psa@kzuu.org. For more information, call our office 335-2208. KZUU is made possible in part by Heroes in Sports, located at 245 Northeast Kamiokin Street. Pullman's hometown deli offers a variety of sandwiches, soups, and salads with catering available. More information can be found by calling Heroes in Sports at 334-5423. Reach us here in the studio at 335-2207 on the web at www.kzuu.org and on our show's website at www.thepes.com, where you can download all the latest and greatest audios from every show that I've done since 2002. Well, except for the ones that the audio is missing on for whatever reason. Like, tapes died, or the internet access died, or any number of other things. But I have a new and wonderful method now where that does not happen, and we have pretty much all the shows. Now, I was a slacker this last week, and I did not get the audio from last week's show up on the air yet, or up on the website yet, but it shall be there soon. When I come back, we'll spend a couple minutes talking about the police chief candidate forum with Bill Gardner that happened up in Leidy on Friday. and we'll hit on a couple other issues. But in the meantime, of course, as always, the favorite of the PES, the Reverend. Reverend Horton Heat. The Reverend. Reverend Horton Heat on KZUU 90.7 FM, the PES, from noon to 2. So, Daily Evergreen today had an article about the visit with Bill Gardner to the campus, talking about some of the things. And pretty much from what it looks like in the article, his big thing is just transparency and honesty and communication, more or less as his top priorities, making sure that everybody knew what the truth was, everybody, no matter how it looked. And, you know, you got situations where, you know, sometimes things might be whitewashed or some things might be downplayed because it doesn't look good for the university. And he said that that needs to not happen. We need to say things as they are and be honest with them, and that there's no reason to not be truthful about this kind of stuff. And one of the specific examples he said was that the department would find and report the real number of sexual assaults on campus, regardless of how it looks for the statistics. And to go with that kind of mentality, the university has been well known over the years for downplaying incidences that have the possibility of giving the university a black eye. For instance, the 1998 riots at WSU, coming up now on 10 years. This May will be 10 years since the riots took place. They were definitely a black eye in the university. Made national headlines. I don't know if I've talked about this recently or not. It seems like I've talked about it various times throughout the years. But essentially, to talk real briefly about the riots, it took place dead week, and it was sort of a party that started up on right off of campus on A Street in Colorado, right in that area. And it was just a really large party that just sort of grew and grew and grew, and people started throwing stuff. The police department was called up there because of a report of a drunk driver that had hit somebody. So they went to investigate somebody getting hit by a car, and this party was very large and very loud as it was, and some of the people decided to, through the anonymity of a large group, decided to start throwing some bottles out of the crowd, or I don't know if they're bottles or cans or rocks or what they were, but they're throwing objects that could definitely cause harm. They're throwing them at the police officers. Well, shortly thereafter, the police officer's like, okay, this is obviously not safe anymore, and we can't find the car, we can't find the person, we're going to back out of here, but now we have a problem going on because we have this party that's just growing and growing and growing. And they decided, okay, well, what we need to do is we need to tell them that they need to, clear the sidewalks and clear the street of people standing out there drinking. It's one thing to be in your private property with an alcohol in hand, but once you go onto the sidewalk or onto the street, you're in a public place, having alcohol in hand is a criminal offense. So they're like, you can't do that. You guys got to get off that area. And anyway, an order is given for people to disperse, and the people didn't want to disperse, so they fought back, and the police showed a little bit more force, and the people started showing some more force, throwing more and more items at the police, and things started getting really out of hand when a fire was started in the middle of A Street and Colorado, in that intersection, with any object that wasn't nailed down at the time was being picked up and thrown on the fire, making this fire really large. And of course, more and more people started showing up because, you know, hey, there's this big party, now it's getting out of hand, more and more people showing up. The cops then asked the bars up on campus to if they would shut down early and get everybody out of there, because they wanted to get everybody off of campus as much as possible. The only problem was all those people from the bars, instead of leaving like they probably should have, decided, hey, let's go out to this party. So then, you know, you empty bars of, you know, hundreds of people and send them out onto the streets. And instead of them going home, they decided to get into this as well. Well, then the cops call for backup and more cops show up, and they decide, okay, let's try to eradicate the situation. And then all of a sudden, it's working for a little while, but then the people outnumbered the cops, you know, 50-1 or so. And soon, the cops got outnumbered and they got surrounded, and they're getting bottles and cans and bricks and cinder blocks and 8-foot sections of chain link fencing, and anything else that could be picked up and thrown at the cops were being thrown at them. There were some 911 tapes that they played on the news in one of them. It almost made the hair on the back of my neck stand up when I listened to it, because it was like you could hear the fear and the excitement, and not an excitement in a good way, but like, you know, somebody's got to do something about this. But you could hear that in the person's voice when he was talking to 911, and he was telling them that these cops were surrounded and they were getting pummeled and beat up and hurt. And he was more or less afraid that if nobody got up there, these cops were going to get killed. I mean, it was to that point. It was that serious. More and more cops started showing up from all sorts of areas. A larger show of force started happening. By the end of the night, 23 cops were sent to the hospital with an assorted number of injuries. Anything from boards with nails in them being swung at cops and sticking in their legs to broken bones, concussions, any number of injuries like that. And it just wasn't a very good situation for the police, of course. Of course, it was a very big black eye towards the students, towards the university. And I guess I don't really want to get into all the stuff of the riot itself much more than that. But what WSU had put out for a press release was an all-night street party dispersed peacefully with small amount of gas and water. So WSU made it sound like, oh, it's just a little party, got a little rambunctious, you know, tiny bit of water and gas was thrown out there and everybody left peacefully. And it was like, no, that's not quite what happened. Thanks for trying, though. And then Pullman, the city of Pullman, put out a press release that gave a little bit more of the details, but they were still very, very... they weren't saying a lot of what happened. And then Sheriff Steve Thompson, who was involved in this whole situation, because the sheriff's office, of course, came up with their group of people. Sheriff Thompson put out approximately a 2-page press release that gave a blow-by-blow detail that left nothing out. He said it as it was. And when you read the press release from WSU and you read the press release from Steve Thompson, they were night and day different. WSU really, really downplayed the situation because it's all damage control for them. Sheriff Thompson had nothing to hide. He doesn't have an allegiance to the university to make it look good. And, you know, it's interesting. Some of the city council ordinances that were put in after the riots were because of the riots. And people throughout the city of Pullman, as well as students, are still today having to deal with these ordinances that were put in because of this riot. And when students today complain about some of the ordinances that are being put into place all the time, what needs to happen is they need to look back 4 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and see why these ordinances were being put into place. You look back to the 1980s and the 1990s, early 90s, before kegs were outlawed from fraternities, before there were noise complaints, before there was any kind of that process, you could go up on Greek Row on any given weekend and you'd find a couple of the fraternities would have the temporary fencing put up with black plastic around the whole entire thing. And they would have huge parties, live bands, loud music that would go for hours on end, kegs, free-flowing alcohol all over the place. And there was nothing that pretty much anybody could do about it. As long as the people were staying within the fenced area, the cops weren't going in there. So underage drinking was very prevalent. The noise would be horrendously loud for hours on end into the wee hours of the morning at times. And nobody really could do anything about it because there was no real noise ordinances out there. So you had a situation where the people on College Hill had so much noise being emitted from the area that anybody who lived in the area, they had a hard time sleeping. But people on the opposite side of town, I mean, you seriously could go out by Dismore's, which is not that far off, but you could keep on going further and further away. You could even get to down by the post office when you get higher up on that hill, and you could hear the music being played all the way across town. You could actually not only just hear music, you could actually pick out two or three different kinds of music being played. It was that loud, and it was that kind of stuff that caused the city to react. And the city would not have had to react if the people who were having these parties were halfway reasonably neighborly. If they decided, well, let's crank it down just a little bit so we could still hear the music and have a good time, but we don't disturb people on the opposite side of town, that people could go to bed at reasonable hours and not be woken up to the loud music. That this whole thing with keeping your yard clean. Well, maybe if people would have kept their yard relatively clean, instead of having a party and leaving the trash that happens after the party, instead of leaving that out there for days and weeks on end, if they would go out there and clean their yards up to have it reasonably well taken care of, you probably wouldn't need these ordinances. And you know, once again, though, you got to look at my libertarian/conservative point of view, and I'm all about not having these kind of ordinances go up. I'm all about having personal freedom. Hey, it's your private property. If you want to have this trash out there, I guess that would be your right to a point. But where does your right end and another guy's right begin? Now, if I own a piece of property right next to you, I have rights of my property. And one of the things I should have the right of is not having my property's value decrease dramatically due to the fact of what you do to your property. Therefore, we have to have some sort of point in the middle where what you do affects me. Therefore, we need to have some sort of common area where we keep ourselves to a certain standard. Now, the average person who actually owns a piece of land and owns a house is probably not going to trash it as much as somebody who's a renter. That's just the way things are. Now, if I were to go up to College Hill today and buy a house, I would know I'm buying houses next to renters. It's sort of like if I bought a house next to a railroad station, or if I were to go out onto Airport Road and buy a house that's in the flight path of the airport. I would have to expect noise. Back in the Renton area where I grew up, there's a gun club that was there from the 1930s on, and housing was developed all around it. Now some of the people who live in the houses are complaining about the noise of the gun club. And the people are like, we've been here since the 1930s. You guys' house were built in the 60s and 70s. You knew what you were buying when you came here. Don't complain to us. You guys encroached on our area, and you came to what you knew there was going to be this loud noise, and you still chose to buy here. We have our right to keep our business going. Now, it'd be one thing, though, if the gun club tried to go in today, because then they would be adding this kind of noise to the area. It's all about, okay, what is the area zoned for? Is it zoned for these kinds of activities? If it's zoned for those kind of activities, and I move in there and then I complain about the fact that it's being used to the potential of the zoning, I don't really have much of an argument. For instance, if I buy a house in an area zoned R3 and R4, and I'm expecting it to be houses all around me, well, I got another thing coming when four or five apartment complexes sprout up around me, and there I am in my private one single family house, and I have 15 or 20 apartment buildings around me. Well, I don't have much room to talk because I knew I was going into an area that could have this kind of potential. But if I buy in a single family neighborhood and all the houses in there are all single family, and that's the way it is, and all of a sudden they all get replaced with rentals, I would still expect that the property value that I have there remain at a certain level, and that the people who live around me live to a certain level. It could definitely be a little sticky, but it's the whole, where does my right end and another guy's rights begin? As long as there's a halfway point and they meet at that halfway point, I think that's about the as reasonable as you're going to be able to get. So these ordinances that are coming about from the city council are coming about because they're reactionary to problems that are existing that students or other renters, but mainly students, because the students even admit that they feel like they're out to get the students, they're unwilling as a group to take care of on their own. When the Daily Evergreen had that article in the paper and they were going around looking at these places where there was trash all over the yard, and then one case, you know, you could see the grounds were covered in leaves that hadn't been raked out since the last fall. So they'd been, you know, the yard was cluttered with leaves and garbage and stuff that had been there for months on end. And you can't tell me that none of those people in that house had half a day, one weekend to rake up the leaves. It's about not caring one bit. And that, I don't think, is an acceptable position to take when it can decrease somebody else's land value, which then, in my view, erodes some of their rights of owning that land. Because I should not have to endure my land value decreasing because of your laziness. So, anyway, going back to the WSU thing and whatnot with this, with Bill Gardner, sort of a little tangent, as I typically am known to do. So, Bill Gardner, I actually don't know him personally, but I know him professionally, and I say that in the way that when I was a WSU student in the education department, back before I switched majors, I had gone out with him to the elementary schools as part of the DARE program. He was a DARE officer, and I was, as part of my classroom work, I actually went out to the classroom with him a couple times and learned some information from him and just watched him do his teaching and all this kind of stuff. And I really liked Bill. He's a very easygoing guy, very, I don't want to say soft-spoken, but he wasn't an in-your-face type of guy when I was ever around. I mean, obviously, if you're dealing with little kids, he had a great ability of doing that. As he points out, he was a WSU police officer, so he has that point of view. He was a Pullman police officer, so he had that point of view. So he's actually worked for both agencies and had some of that kind of interaction. He actually worked with some of the officers he would be leading if he were to get this job, some of the officers who's been around for, 15 or 20 years or so. So when I heard Bill Gardner was applying for this, I was really excited. I would like to see him get the job. Some people probably would prefer somebody from outside of the area get the job, so you got fresh blood, fresh ideas, fresh everything. But I think it'd be neat to see Bill Gardner get that opportunity. I just hope that WSU doesn't do to him what it is known to do to other people. WSU is not always the most friendly place to be in any kind of leadership position. WSU is very well known for pushing. If they don't like somebody, or if they don't like the way somebody runs things, if they don't run things the way that that WSU likes, they'll push them out the door in any means necessary. And I believe that if Gardner were to take such a position that causes WSU to get black eyes because he says things how they are, WSU might not like that too much, and that might be WSU's way of pushing him out the door. I don't know. I just really hope that this is a positive move for WSU, and I hope it's a really positive move for Bill Gardner because he's a great guy, and I'd love to see the best for him. So, speaking of Bill, this is interesting. On April, and in the month of April, I always think about this one event that took place in Pullman. It was called the Pullman Easter Massacre. Bill Gardner was the one who originally told me about this back when I was doing the DARE stuff with him, and I was really interested about it, so I started doing research, and I'd spend some time at the WSU library pulling out the old microfiche and or the microfilms. I'm not sure what they're called. It's a roll. All the newspapers are put them on them, and you can sit there and read, you know, old newspapers. And I'd go through the old Evergreens and Spokesman Review and Pullman Herald and a couple other newspapers of that are there that have local stories of interest. Because I'm always curious about local things that happened back in the day. Like, I used to always wonder what it would have been like to have been a student, say, in the 1970s. Like one day I was coming back from the roto heading towards Stevenson, and somebody had a speaker in the window and they're blasting music. It was, you know, Friday around 5-6 in the afternoon. So people are getting ready. They're getting ready for the weekend. They're getting all pumped up, ready to go. They got, you know, the latest, greatest music is playing, being blown out the windows and stuff. And I was like, I wonder what it would have been like in the 1970s to be walking the same path with the music being played like it is now, but it would be the latest and greatest stuff from the 70s. Things like, you know, could you imagine being alive when Led Zeppelin 4 came out and Stairway to Heaven was played on the radio for the very first time? You could go, wow, that was incredible. I mean, just to hear the DJ say, and new from Led Zeppelin 4, a new one called Stairway to Heaven. And then they start playing it, and it's like, it would just be incredible. Or even when Dark Side of the Moon came out, some of the songs from there, Time and Us and Them and Money, that just to have those played on the radio for the very first time, it would just be incredible to be able to remember that and have those songs be new, you know. It'd be such a different period of time. And then what was the point of view of people on campus? What were the styles like? What kind of things did they do on the weekends? How much different was it then to now? And, you know, so I was thinking about that kind of stuff. And I'm always curious about what it was like as a student back in the 1970s, back in the 1960s, back in the 50s. I love looking at the old Chinooks and looking at the kind of events that they held up on campus, looking how campus looked like back in the day. So when he told me about what had happened here, I was really interested. So I started reading the stuff about the Pullman Easter Massacre. And there were police officers, Pullman police officers and Whitman County sheriffs who were shot and killed during this event. I mean, it was a big thing. It made national news. When I learned about those officers that got killed, I got interested to know more about some of the other police officers that have been killed in Whitman County in the line of duty. And I actually went back and I researched every single officer who's died in the line of duty in Whitman County, and found newspaper articles about the whole entire thing. And it was really interesting because there was another Pullman cop, I believe his name was Bill McGuire, or William McGuire, who was shot and killed during a possible robbery situation that happened in Pullman down sort of by the Grange supply where that is located, back in the, I believe it was the 1930s, 1932 or so. He was shot and killed during that robbery and the people were never caught. There was a Tico town marshal that was killed they'd gone up to shut down a saloon and the saloon owner didn't really want to get shut down and ended up shooting some people before he committed suicide. And then Roselia, and I sometimes get the two backwards, and then in Roselia, I believe it was, and these, once again, this one could have happened, Roselia, Tico, backwards, whatever, but both of them were sort of up north of the county. There was a big fire had taken place on one end of town. And when the town marshal was heading out that way, he noticed a lot of the cars that were in town had flat tires. And on the other side of town was a bank. And he's like, huh, interesting. Cars with flat tires, a fire all on one end of town, and everybody's running that way. And he decided to go to the other end of town to where the bank was. And sure enough, there's a robbery going on. Fire was set as a distraction. And he ended up getting shot and killed during this. But I thought it was really interesting that he was able to look at all this information and go, you know what, I'm thinking there could be something on the other side of town going on. I better go over there and check it out. And sure enough, there was. But in the case of Pullman, the Easter Massacre, if you get the Daily News, dnews.com, or if you actually get the subscription of the Daily News, take a look at the opinion section on Wednesday. This coming Wednesday, I'll have I get a column every 13 weeks, part of the Town Crier 3 series, and I'll have a column in there about the Easter Massacre. Unfortunately, it can only be 700 words long, and because of that, I'm not going to have a lot of detail in there about a lot of the things that happened before the event, and even during the event, there's a lot of stuff I'm leaving out. And then after the event, a lot of the things that have come of it. But I have on the PES.com, the www.thepes.com, I actually have an audio file from April of 2006. It's a 2-hour interview with a guy named Carl Hooterman, who I would guess would be the expert on the situation. He has researched this since his student days at WSU back in the 1980s. And he's talked to many, many of the people who have been involved in this situation. And I've actually talked to him in person and via the radio. I've interviewed him twice on this radio show. And I think the second interview was better between the two. And that one is available online. You could download and listen to the whole thing. And so it's an event that comes up, and every April I sort of think about it. And on the 50th anniversary of this event, which was in 1999, was the 50th anniversary. It happened in 1949, April 17th, 1949. On the 50th anniversary, I actually wrote a larger article that appeared on the front page of the living section, or you know, the local section of the Lewiston Morning Tribune. And it talked about this whole entire thing, and I went in a lot more in depth. But just to give you a brief synopsis of the whole situation, and when I say brief, I'll be as brief as I am. So what had happened was is that there was a guy named George McIntyre, and so let me set the stage. George McIntyre is in his mid to late 20s. He was a World War II veteran. He was in Pullman. There, so you got to realize, Pullman in 1949 was a lot different than it is today, in a lot of ways. The population of Pullman obviously was smaller. The population of Pullman had a lot of military. At the time, there was a lot of military houses, I believe. I haven't seen a lot of photos, but from my understanding, North Fairway Road, which has pretty much one apartment complex on it now, was covered in military housing. If you go up by the old, the North Fairway playfields, where they have a rugby field, soccer field, sometimes they play softball and whatnot, a lot of intramural events sort of out there on the edge of campus. My understanding is there used to be a lot of military housing up there, because if you ever go to that parking lot, those driveway parts of the parking lot actually have street names. And my understanding is they were named back when there was housing there. And then down across the cross stadium way from Stevenson, which is now sort of just grassy land by Spokane and stuff, my understanding is there used to be military housing there. I mean, I understand that there's a lot of military housing around, and I haven't seen photos, and, you know, some of this is just, I mean, this is all hearsay, I don't know for sure, but, so there's a lot of military people in Pullman at the time. You had a, you know, Greek Row still existed. Grand Avenue was two lanes wide instead of four lanes wide. Right where Cougar Country Cafe is, and just to the south of that is the laundromat that's there, and there used to be a Greens Cleaners in there, but now it's just a laundromat. That area there used to be a junkyard. It was called Scrappies, or I don't know if it was called Scrappies, but the guy who owned it was, everybody called him Scrappy. And actually, if you go to the laundromat, I can't remember if it's the left side or the right side of the building, but if you're facing the building from the Grand Avenue side, one of the two sides of it actually has a memorial plaque in the building that sort of pays homage to Scrappies. And, you know, so you can read all about that right there. But, or maybe next time you go to Cougar Country, just run over there and take a look at it. It's sort of interesting. So Grand Avenue was two lanes wide. Cougar Country did not exist at the time. There was sort of a junkyard and stuff there. But, you know, so sort of imagine, if you will, and I don't know if you've ever really paid attention to what's behind Cougar Country, but if you go behind Cougar Country, you got the Tesoro gas station, Cougar Country, and the laundromat. Right behind it is part of a river, one of the forks of the river. And then if you get across the fork of the river, you got a couple tracks of railroad tracks. After you get over those railroad tracks, there's actually an access road, and it's called Railroad Avenue, or Railroad Road. I don't know exactly if it's Avenue, Road, whatever. But anyway, the point is there's actually still a road, and it still exists today, but that was a road. And then past that road is a hillside, and the hillside goes up. And if you go up it, I don't know exactly how many feet, I would guess 30, 35 feet or so. When you get up to the top of that, you have Maple Street Extension. And just off of Maple Street Extension is the Paul Allen House. I think it's Phi Kappa Theta or something like that, one of the fraternities. It's the one that you always see if you're looking up the hillside from that area. So there you have essentially Grand Avenue, the business, a river, railroad tracks, railroad road, and a hillside going up to Maple Street Extension. Across the street from there, you have what is now Snap Fitness, and then you have a little road that goes off at an angle between Snap Fitness and that one business. I think it's called ICC, and if you've been around for a while, before that it was Anderson Lumber, before that it was Rima Building Supply. There's a little diagonal road between the two there, and that's Ritchie. And if you go up Ritchie Street, as soon as you get up Ritchie Street, it sort of takes a dog leg to the left, and that turns into Harrison. If you were to continue on the street at that point, you'd still be on Ritchie. So if you get to the intersection of Ritchie and Harrison, right about there is where, in that general vicinity, I've never seen or I've never been given a good address, but George McIntyre lived up there. At the time where the ICC was, that was a dairy, Milky Way Dairy, and then I believe where the Snap Fitness is, it was a tractor selling place, like a tractor implement or something like that. So this sort of setting the table a little bit. You got a two-lane Grand Avenue, obviously not as much traffic as there is today. You got other businesses that are not in existence today. Buildings might still sort of be the same, I'm not sure. So George McIntyre and some of the people in town had run-ins before. George McIntyre was a sniper in World War II. My understanding is he did well in the war. He had a wife and kids here in Pullman. He also owned a electrical repair business, and it was downtown Pullman, pretty much where I believe Whitman Escrow is today. So that would be on the east side of Grand Avenue. Pretty much if you come out of, say, Pizza Pipeline, you got the church that it was in the Cordova movie theater, and then you got Shirt Shack, and then H&R Block. You have those businesses right there. Directly across the street is Whitman County Title and Escrow, something like that. And that is the spot, from everything I've been able to determine, is where George McIntyre's business was located. Well, even back then, there wasn't a lot of parking there, and McIntyre would deliver different kinds of electronics from his business to the people who were having them worked on. Well, the problem was, because of the parking problem, sometimes he would double park in order to load stuff up. And the story is that the cops in Pullman at the time did not like George McIntyre living here, and supposedly, and once again, this is not in official records. This is, you know, person to person, like, you know, listening to stories from people who were around at the time. This is what they're saying. The cops sort of were, if the cops wanted to run somebody out of town, they would just sit there and more or less pick on them until the person left. And supposedly that was happening to George McIntyre. So anytime he double parked, as soon as the cops saw it, they'd run over there and write him a ticket right away. And whether that was because they were picking on George to get him out of town, or whether that was because he's double parking, he's been told not to, he knows not to, and he does it anyway, and he doesn't care, they're going to give him a ticket, blocking traffic, whatever, I don't know. I don't want to make value judgments on the cops, because I wasn't there, I don't know the situation, I'm only going with what people are saying, and, you know, some of the people I talked to, it had been 50 years, you know, it's hard to say that they have an exact recollection of everything that was going on at the time. And people sometimes seem to have agendas, and sometimes they want to blame other people for certain people's actions. Well, anyway, so I'm just saying it as I've been told it. The cops were out to get George. They wrote him tickets. They were always riding him whenever they had a chance. Well, there were also people in town who didn't like George because they felt he was a hothead, that he was not a very nice guy, maybe. He was... he would speed down the road, like where all this military housing was out there on North Fairway, for instance. There's a guy named Hiram Kershaw who lived out there, and him and George would have run-ins because George would speed down that road, and there'd be kids out there playing and stuff, and him and George would always have words. Well, a situation had taken place about a year before this event in 1949. It could have been 2 years, 1947, 1948, right in there. A fight had taken place down by the Milky Way Dairy, down by even further down on State Street by the Grange, where a fight had taken place, and I believe it was Kershaw was on the running board of George's truck and reached across to hit George, but George's wife was there and she was pregnant and she actually got hurt in this, and George was driving down the road and tried to more or less scrape the guy off by getting close up to the edge of the road and the guardrail and everything. Well, later on, George shows up, or George had with him a gun and pointed it at these people. Well, according to one of the people I interviewed in Pullman, it wasn't a gun, it was just a gun stock. And this was the evidence to this was after George got angry, he broke it over his knee. And, but it's hard to say whether it was really a gun or a gun stock or whatever, but essentially, it was reported to Ross Clare. Ross Clare was a Pullman police officer, and George ends up getting arrested for assault in the first degree or second degree. Essentially, pointing a gun or what people believe to be a gun at them is an assault, and he got taken to jail. The whole court proceedings and everything. Well, anyway, a year later, he has a warrant for his arrest on these charges. I don't know if he had failed to appear for a hearing or if he wasn't doing what he was supposed to or whatever. But so you got George, who had been in fights with people. There are certain people in town that he obviously just doesn't get along with. The cops seem to be picking on him, so that probably doesn't give him a very good attitude. But then you got these other people in town that are saying George is the greatest guy in the world. He is awesome with the kids. He's a Boy Scout leader. He does a really good job with them. We love George. We trust him. He's a great guy. So you have these two sides of town that they love him or hate him type of thing. And I'm sure a lot of people didn't know who this guy was, but I'm saying of the people who either knew him or didn't know him, I mean, of the people who knew him, there's essentially the two sides. So George is wanted on a warrant because of this assault that had taken place a year before. And the police, the sheriff's office, had been looking for him, and they'd been in Pullman, but they couldn't find him, so they left. George and his family had gone to Moscow Mountain for the day. It's Easter Sunday. It's a very nice afternoon day, unlike the last couple years where Easter seems to be falling on days where it snows. It's a very nice Easter day. They'd gone up to Moscow Mountain, and they're like, okay, hey, we're going to go down to Colfax. On their way to Colfax, they stopped to get some fuel, and they were at essentially where Beasley Realty is now, which is across from the National Guard Armory and the Taco Time downtown Pullman, where Grand Avenue and Paradise, or Main Street and Paradise, meet. There's the Beasley Realty, and I guess right there was a gas station. And McIntyre had stopped there to get some gas before they headed to Colfax. Well, Ross Clare was driving by in a patrol car and saw McIntyre, and from what Hooterman had written about, more or less, Ross Clare pulls in and says, hey, Mac, I'm going to take you in for the sheriff. And he went to his car to grab a billy club, and McIntyre pulled out a .22 pistol and says, like hell you are, and shot Ross Clare several times. Ross Clare went down. McIntyre's wife and young kids were not in the vehicle at the time, and they wouldn't get back in with him after this happened. His wife, I guess, sort of stayed away, and he got in his vehicle and drove off down Main Street and went to his house, which, once again, this is down. Now he's gone down Main Street, gone down Grand Avenue. He's over by where Cougar Country is today, went to his house. He grabbed a rifle and a pair of binoculars, and remember, this guy's a sniper, not quite the guy you want to go up in a fight against. And he goes across Grand Avenue, gets across the river, across railroad tracks, goes up on that little hillside underneath the Maple Street extension. So he's over there, and Ross Clare is shot and ultimately dies. The sheriff and other deputies are radioed about what just happened, so they turn around. They're on their way back to town. In the meantime, McIntyre's business partner picks up the wife and kid and drives them to McIntyre's home. Well, when Gilbert Gallagher, one of the sheriff's deputies, a 28-year-old who was a recent grad of Washington State College, he got to town and he drove down Railroad Avenue. So he's sort of at the base of that hill, driving down the road, looking off at McIntyre's house, and he saw McIntyre's vehicle. And from a distance, he saw a man matching the description of McIntyre standing there. And he goes, okay, and to himself, he's probably thinking, okay, there's McIntyre's vehicle. There's McIntyre. I see where he is. I'm going to go down there and, you know, keep an eye on him until I get more people here. So he pulls down Railroad Avenue, stops his car, gets out of it, goes to the side of the car opposite of where he thinks McIntyre is. So essentially, the hillside and his car and Gilbert Gallagher is standing there. Well, little does he know, McIntyre is just up on the hill just above him. He thought McIntyre was all the way across the street, all the way up the hillside, but no, McIntyre was 15 or 20 feet behind him. And he didn't even know what happened. Got shot in the back and killed. So McIntyre grabs Gilbert's rifle as well. So now McIntyre has a couple guns, a pair of binoculars, and obviously is meaning business. So people in Pullman start coming in, and reports are, and I don't, I've never seen this for sure, but from what I understand, the report, the news was actually saying, and the reports were being put out there, help us get this guy. They were asking the citizens for help. And you got to realize back at the time that this is going on, a lot of the people were former military. There's a lot of people who know what they're doing out there, I guess you could say. And they're asking for the help to come out here and get McIntyre before, you know, anybody else gets shot and killed, I guess. So Ernest Buck, who was a local taxi driver, and another guy who was a Pullman citizen, they're up on the Maple Street extension. They sort of came down, and they're talking to one another, and they're talking about trying to figure out where McIntyre is and all this kind of stuff. Well, McIntyre is right there, and little did they know, he ends up having Ernest Buck go to the hillside. And he shoots at the top of the hillside. He shoots Ernest Buck, and Ernest Buck goes down the hill. Ernest Buck dies. So now we have a Pullman police officer, a Whitman County sheriff deputy, and a local taxi driver all shot and killed during this event. And the other person who had been talking with Ernest, the other Pullman citizen, was shot as well, and he sort of got away, got around to this backside of the car, and McIntyre went following after him and leveled his gun at this Pullman citizen. And what was reported, the exchange was essentially, come on, Mac, you don't want to kill me. And then McIntyre's response was more or less like, then get the hell out of here. And this Pullman citizen's wife and a college student helped get him to the hospital, which was at the time located on WSU's campus at the corner of Nevada and Washington Street, where currently the Washington building is now located. That's the old hospital. So they got him out of there, and he ends up living. Well, the sheriff comes into town around 4:30 in the afternoon. He didn't know everything that was going on because it was really chaotic by this time, and he didn't know where McIntyre was. From what it sounds like, they more or less went right to McIntyre's house. They're up there, I think, on Ritchie and Harrison, right in that area. Well, McIntyre is still on this hillside across the way. So McIntyre essentially has a two-lane road with enough room for a four-lane road. Obviously, the scrapyard, the river, the railroad tracks, railroad avenue, the hillside, plus the hillside of the opposite side of the road. So he had that much space. I don't know. I would guess, you know, several hundred yards between where McIntyre was and where the sheriff was. The sheriff steps out of the patrol car as soon as they arrive and gets shot once. And from the reports, he was shot once right in the heart, killed instantly. And then he shot at the deputy who was also in the car with the sheriff's. And the deputy got shot and injured, but not killed. So now we have Sheriff Parnell. We have police officer Ross Clare. We have Deputy Sheriff Gilbert Gallagher. And we have Ernest Buck, the taxi driver, all shot and killed. So now we have Washington State Patrol coming to town. We have all sorts of other people are coming to town, you know, the citizens in town are being told, hey, help us get this guy. So now all of a sudden the hunt is on for George McIntyre. And as he's being surrounded, he comes down the hillside a little ways, and official report is he commits suicide. And he did this by shooting himself 3 times in the heart with a bolt-action rifle. Now, if you don't know much about guns, this probably did not raise a red flag just now. But if you know a lot about guns, you're looking at your radio like, did he just say what I think I said? And yes, I did say that. He was shot. He shot himself 3 times in the heart with a bolt action rifle. And for those who don't know what that means, that essentially means after the shot is done, he has to take a lever and pull it back several inches, push it forward several inches, and put it back in a seated position. So in order to do this action, even when you're really fast, if you've ever watched any war movies and you've seen people work bolt-action rifles, it can be pretty fast. But imagine if you're shooting yourself, that's pretty far away from you. And if you shoot yourself in the heart, one would think that you would be pretty much immediately dead. So to shoot yourself in the heart and then be able to function a bolt-action rifle with a rifle away from you, shoot yourself a second time, and then once again be able to operate a bolt-action rifle, and then to shoot yourself a third time in the heart, one would think that you wouldn't be able to do that. So Of course, that's a conspiracy theory about the whole situation. So I actually looked up the name of the doctor who was part of the autopsy of the situation. He was still alive. And I asked him, I said, okay, how can a guy shoot himself 3 times in the heart with a bolt-action rifle to commit suicide? And he said, well, what happens is when you shoot yourself in the heart, though your blood supply immediately stops to the brain, you're alive long enough to be able to do certain actions. And he was a sniper, trained military guy, and he was in good shape. He was able to function for probably 5 to 10 to maybe 15 seconds after the blood stopped going to his brain, which allowed him the time to shoot himself in the heart 3 times. Well, just a couple footnotes to this whole thing. Some people believe that the reason why that the official story is he shot himself in the heart is to protect other people, because more or less he shot and killed a sheriff, the deputy sheriff, the Pullman police officer, and he was just trying to, they were just trying to protect people. KZU, you're on the air. Maybe. KZU, you're on the air. Oh, let's try that now. KZU, you're on the air. KZU. Alrighty. Obviously, we're having that phone problem again. Anyway, I've got less than about 30 seconds to wrap this all up, but essentially, bottom line was, people were saying they're trying to protect whoever it was that shot him. Don't know what the actual situation was. Some people say it was an automatic rifle that was being used, and they wanted to protect the guy with that. Some people say a Washington State trooper walked up to him and more or less executed him. If you want to hear the whole story and hear more information about it, go check the website, www.thepes.com. Go back to April of 06, and you can download the whole 2-hour episode that I had about this. In the meantime, this will be my sign-off. I got, what band here? Beach from the Beach House, from the from the album Devotion. And I will play for you song number 2, which is You Came to Me.